This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, this is Ari Marmel, author of Drell of the Underdark, Complete Champion, Complete Mage, and Forge of War, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 158. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I'm going to spend decades and my entire life savings tunneling into the ground and devising complex mechanical systems, all designed to stop a small group of foolhardy adventurers from getting to me. And when they come, I will hide in the deepest part, where all of my strongest defenses are, since I really don't mind them destroying the rest of my home, and wait patiently for them to get all the way to me, at which point I will almost certainly die, because that is the way Mike Shea and Tracy Hurley told me to do things, in this episode about dungeon advice. That's right, there's not going to be any mini segments in this advice episode from SarahDarkMagic.com or SlyFlourish.com, because they are on as my dual advice guests. Mike, Tracy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, before we get into what we're going to get into, there is, I think, some news worth discussing in the D&D world, some of which pertains to me. So let's start with that. I have recently appeared on an episode of the DM's Roundtable, actually for the second time, but the first time I was only on for like a minute and a half. This time I think I stayed on for a whole, 15 minutes or so. So that was exciting. And I think, Mike, did you join that episode after I left?
Yeah, I did. I missed you by like 2 minutes, and we ended up telling the exact same story.
What story did we tell?
About how I met you for dinner and immediately referred to you as Jeff Greiner.
Oh, well, good. Yeah. Good.
So we both told that story.
And Tracy, you were not on that episode, as I recall.
Not at all. I was on it.
Wow. Are they allowed to do that?
I was on it. They are allowed to have ones without me. Usually not worth it, but...
But it's not worth it to listen if you're not there?
I didn't say that.
It's not like you say any, it's not like you ever talk when you're on an episode anyway.
No, never.
Oh man, we're already starting right in.
I mentioned, I think it was on Twitter the last night, that I'm going to mentor Tracy here and make her into my eventual replacement so I can just stop podcasting. So I've got to get her in shape.
Yeah, I saw somebody else reply too that, wait, we're finally going to hear Tracy speak. So that was great.
Well, we've got lots of opportunities for you to speak in this episode, because this one focuses
on Deaths of Dungeons.
On you.
Yeah.
Hey.
What?
We'll get there. We'll get there. Hold on. All right. The other thing that I've done recently that I wanted to pimp a little bit here is that over the week of Thanksgiving and finishing today as we're recording, I did a series of articles that appeared on three different sites across the interweb, focusing on an artifact that I created for a follower on Twitter who said, "Hey, I need an artifact. Where do you think I can find one?" And I said, "Hey, what do you need? I'll make it." And I figured, well, why go to all the trouble of putting together an artifact if I'm not going to turn it into content for something. So I turned it into content for three somethings. On temporary hit points, I did an article on players and how players can use artifacts to help push their personal background or character development. On SlyFlourish.com with Mike Shea, he was gracious enough to let me do a rare guest post on the site where I talked about how to use the artifact as a DM and how you might incorporate artifacts into your game. And then just today, or last night, I guess technically, Miss Tracy Hurley from SarahDarkMagic.com also allowed me a guest post there where I talked about, you know, what I did or what my mentality was as I designed it and how I designed it. So I want, while I have you both here, thanks for letting me do that.
Sure.
Yeah, no problem.
I hope your readers didn't hate it too much.
Nope.
No, I think they liked it.
Well, that's good. Good. All right. Let's get into some D&D news that doesn't necessarily have to do with me. I mean, I know that I am the most interesting thing going on in the D&D community, but still, I think there's some other things people might want to hear about. For example, the virtual tabletop is done. surprisingly out of the blue. The one they announced, what, 3-4 years ago? Everybody sort of assumed at this point was just not going to happen. Well, it turns out it's out, but it's invite only beta. So it's not really out to the public yet. I assume both of you have played with it because everybody loves you.
Yeah, we played last night.
Yep. Yep.
You actually got to play on it too, huh?
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. This is
one-on-one DM versus player adventure.
Yeah, and he totally kills my monsters. I'm not happy. I'm going to have to go back and design them better.
Yeah, my Slayer did very well.
Very cool. How long did it take? You ran just one encounter?
Yeah. Like, not even one encounter.
How long did that process take?
I don't know. 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah, it was really easy on Mike's side. And then it took me under an hour with learning how to use Virtual Table to get all the monsters in and to create the dungeon from the tiles and everything.
All right, so it took you an hour or so to figure out how it works and make an encounter, and the whole encounter went about 15, 20 minutes, and you were in and out. Yeah.
It was one character, so it's not exactly
a
five-character thing. Yeah, I put together – I actually dragged out my copy of the Dungeon Delve book and made a exact replica of the third-level Dungeon Delve. And I think I had the whole thing together in about 10 or 15 minutes and figured that I would just use the Monster Vault to run the actual monsters for it. So it was very – I like it a lot. I'm pretty impressed. I'm very impressed with the things that they didn't put in it, that it's a very focused tool that where they did not incorporate any rules into the system at all. You still have to manage all the rules. But it seems to do what it does pretty well. I just wish it had more content. I want more tiles and more minis, and then I'd be very happy.
Yeah, and I think the killer thing that I'm sure is high on their list to bring in is the ability to import monsters and characters so that you don't have to spend the time entering all that.
Right.
But it is in beta, so I think it looks pretty good. With the very short amount of time that I've spent with it, it looks pretty good for a beta release. And hopefully they have it good and done before they actually release it to the general public.
Right.
Related to that, they also announced that sometime in December, possibly by the time you're hearing this, if they surprise us, they're looking to release the new Adventure Tools application, which is going to be a web app, just like the new Character Builder is, with the Monster Builder in it, and with the all the new Essentials and Dark Sun materials that we've been waiting for months. Now, hopefully, it's a bit more ready at launch than the Character Builder was.
I must have been the only one. I was okay with the Character Builder.
I'm okay with the Character Builder, but they admit pretty openly that there's a lot of things that they should have had in it that it doesn't have.
I mean, you should have been able to output a PDF, and you should have been able to download a character. I mean, I was at a game day recently, an RPGA game, and everybody was complaining about the Character Builder. And I just haven't had the problems with it, but I'm primarily in the DM side too, so I don't have a lot of complications.
Yeah,
but right. I'm okay, and I think like Tracy, said this in somewhere else, that hey, I got to make a character on my Mac.
Yeah,
that was really exciting to me.
So one thing with the monster
and go ahead.
I was just saying the one thing with the Monster Builder is that the exports and stuff I think are a lot more important. Because you do want to be able to put them elsewhere and put them into a document that you can print out and have at the table a lot more, I think, so than the Character Builder stuff.
Yeah, exporting the Character Builder stuff never really bothered me that much because everybody on the planet can get a free program to print to PDF if you can't do it already anyway.
It's just,
so everybody can pretty much do it anyway.
I mean, it's easy for us. We have PDF, print to PDF is built into a Mac, but PC, you got to go find something and you got to go install it, and that's a kind of a chore. But I can see that people didn't have that really easily.
So just go buy a Mac. Just joking.
Yeah. we just lost like 3/4 of our listeners.
Right. I had a hefty conversation with somebody related to that topic recently on Twitter, and I eventually got to a point where it's like, you know what? I'm just being baited into this argument, and I'm done with it now. I'm not going to keep
25 year argument.
Right. All in all, It's out. It's done. That's the direction they're going. And I think both for all three of the tools we've now seen that they've released as web apps, I think have a lot of potential. I know I plan on spending another episode this month later on talking about the character builder specifically. So if you want to give me your gripes or your questions or hear my responses about different things, you can feel free to call up the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZTOME. And I will respond to whatever you send in. And hopefully if I get it real fast, I will be able to address any questions with the guests as we record and with the guests that I'm having on from Wizards of the Coast to interview about the character builder. So that episode should be coming the second half of the month. So call up. All right. One last bit of news. And this is not something that Wizards of the Coast has done. It is something that a bunch of bloggers have done. And it is called Home Encounters. And Tracy's going to tell us about it.
So most people have heard of D&D Encounters at your local game store. So a bunch of bloggers, a lot of whom can't get to a game store to play, and they decided, hey, let's make our own. And that's what they're doing. They made a series of one-encounter adventures that tie together. It's Newbie DM, Quinn Murphy, Game Fiend, and Mark Meredith, right?
Sounds right to me.
Yeah, and they just released it this week, I believe. Or last week.
Yep.
So, or a couple weeks ago, depending on when I get this out.
Right.
My plan is to release this episode on Saturday, so by then it'll probably be a couple of weeks. So good. So if people are looking for an opportunity to get involved in a situation like Encounters but don't have the chance or the time to get to a game store, you can go check out Home Encounters, and I will try to figure out where their website is and link to it in the show notes. I'm sure it won't be hard to find. I know those guys, so I can always ask if I have to. And see what they're up to and see if that's going to fit your needs better. Maybe when it's all said and done, Home Encounters is going to work really well with the virtual tabletop and people can just do their encounters on the interwebs. And unless anybody has anything else, I'm going to call that the news for the day.
Yeah, I don't have anything.
Sounds good.
All right, that's the news. Today, in this episode, we are going to resolve a bit of a problem that's been brewing on the internet for a while now. Miss Tracy Hurley here has informed the world that she hates dungeons. Mike Shea, on the other hand, he gets it. So,
no bias here.
I see how this right. is. This thunderdoming.
Right. Put it all out there. So I decided to bring these two together and broker a settlement. Mike and I are going to try to build a dungeon concept that Tracy can walk away relatively happy with. And then we're going to talk about how players can sort of navigate the usual pitfalls of being a player in a dungeon. But first, I think it's best that we get some history on our guests and some history on the dispute. So let's find out about have either of you ever been guests on an advice episode before? Mike, you might have been.
I think so. I don't know. I'm everywhere.
I know, but I've had both of you on enough, and I don't know that I've really had the chance to get your gaming history out there. So let's start with my usual first question of, how did you first get into D&D?
Which one of us are you asking?
That's going to be a surprise. Whoever starts talking first, that's who I'm asking.
And that'll always be me. how did I first get into D&D? Yes. So I had a friend of mine that, you know, was, I think he's my oldest friend. I think we've known each other since I was three. So that'd be a long time, 34 years, I guess. And, he got into Dungeons and Dragons when we were in junior high, and he had a big suitcase, like his dad's old suitcase. And he carried around all the boxes. And I remember seeing all the box sets. He had the basic set and the advanced set and the expert set and the god set. And then he told me about it and I thought it was so lame. So I didn't do anything with it then. But then I got into it when I was in high school with second edition. And I ran a Forgotten Realms campaign. And that was fun. And then I went into college and played second edition there for a couple of years until we all became Magic the Gathering addicts. And that was in 93 or so. and then stopped playing until I moved to DC and met my my now wife, who knew some gaming friends, and we put together a 3.5 game, and that went. We had kind of variants of that 3.5 game for a couple of years, and then I really got into it, and I was. It was funny because I was really looking at how to incorporate the Dungeons and Dragons miniatures rules into my 3.5 game, which was an unholy mess by the time it was 13th or 14th level. And I needed something far simpler to have fun. And D&D miniatures had a really fun rule system that I liked. So I was trying to incorporate a lot of rules, like no Vancian magic and heavy use of the Book of Nine Swords and stuff like that. And then 4th edition came out, and it was exactly what I wanted. So... then I've been playing 4th edition since the day they put a adventure out. Like before the books had come out, they put out Keeping the Shadowfell. And we started playing right away, and we played all the way through to level 30, which ended about 3 weeks ago. And I think I was about a year in when I decided to start Sly Flourish. I wanted to build a website focused on tips for dungeon masters specifically, instead of there's a lot of sites that do reviews and a lot of sites that talk about other games. And I just wanted to focus on DM stuff to help people run better Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition games. And that's about it.
Right on. So he told me his whole story. Tracy, your story will be faster, right? Because you just started playing a year and a half ago.
Well, so yes and no. I do have to make a confession. I've been around the D&D brand for almost my entire life. We started playing Treasures of Tarmin on the Intellivision way, like when I was little. I probably was 7 or 8 or younger when we started playing that. My brother was a huge D&D person through high school and I think a little middle school. And then most of my friends in college all played. So I've been around D&D for a long time, but I did only start playing almost 2 years ago. It'd be 2 years in February. I listened to the Penny Arcade podcast, I liked the story they were telling. It seemed like they were having a lot of fun. We were already hosting my husband's gaming group, and they needed a player, so I jumped in. And I started my blog pretty much right away when I started just writing about my experiences. I started Twitter almost right away, too. Sarah Dark Magic was actually the name of my first character. I had no idea that people were going to know it or care about it later. I just wanted to get some idea of what I was doing and getting some of the questions answered so I didn't look like an idiot at the table. And it worked pretty well.
So you've covered how you got into D&D. You've covered my next set of questions as well. and I know that Mike is still looking for an opportunity to mention slyflourish.com/blog or /book. What am I talking about? slyflourish.com/book. So let's talk about... I might have. Let's talk briefly about some of the more, I guess, advanced work that the two of you have done recently. So, Mike, tell us the story about your book, and then Tracy's going to tell us about some of the stuff she's been doing lately.
I read a really cool business book called Rework, which is written by the president of the guy who runs a 10-man web operation called 37 Signals and named Jason Fried. And he's a really interesting guy. And he has kind of a really different approach to looking at business that those of us in business find really fascinating. And I love the book because it was this very short, very focused book that had like, you know, 350 word chapters on how to deal with hiring and, you know, how meetings are terrible for productivity and stuff like that. But I really like the style of the book. And I said, I want to do something like that, but I want to do it for D&D. And I'd also really like the idea of digital, you know, producing a book digitally. And I just love how we're living in a time where some jackass like me can sit down and write a book and, you know, do a little bit of HTML markup and turn it into an ebook and sell it on Amazon and sell it myself and sell it on the iBook store and never have to deal with a publisher. You know, my friends helped me with the editing. I commissioned art from Jared von Hinman, who did all the internal art and did the cover. And the whole thing was done myself. So there was no, you know, editorial staff. There was no agent. There was no, you know, no distribution worries. And it was just really fun to do. And I wanted to do a book that was, you know, kind of a primer on the stuff I've been talking about in the blog. So it's not quite as specific as the stuff that you see in the blog, but it kind of captures a bunch of principles, or attempts to capture a bunch of principles for running really good games, and give you practical tips, things that you could use right away, things that you could read and go, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And something that you could reread over and over again, or, you know, something that, you know, I really have this image of a bunch of dog-eared, beaten up copies of this thing that people have been using for years and years. So that was the story behind that.
Right on. And Tracy, you've been doing some publishing stuff lately yourself, have you not?
Yeah, I signed on as a...
I assume you're allowed to talk about that.
Yeah, I signed on as a senior patron to the Lost City project, which is an open design project run through Cobalt Quarterly. And one of the things that senior patrons get to do is pitch for a section. In this case, it was for a section of the book. I get to create an adventure and write out basically a section of the city. And I submitted my pitch. They're all done anonymously. And I came in second, and the top three got in. So now I'm going to be an author on it. So that was really interesting and cool. And I'm having a lot of fun with it, although I have to admit, it's a lot of work. Work I love, but still work.
Sure.
By the time you've gone through a monster for the 10th time, you know, your eyes start glazing over a little bit.
Well, good. So we've got two people that I think we all know each other pretty well. And now you guys know, the listeners here know Tracy and Mike a little better and some of their fantastic credentials. Mm-hmm. So we know a little bit that you guys at least know some of what you're talking about here. So let's go back and tell the story about how Tracy hates dungeons. Tracy, explain this to us.
Okay, so I wrote two posts on my site about dungeons, and in particular types of dungeons and why I don't like them, a few months ago. And poor Mike read that I had written this and responded on Twitter like as if I had killed his dog or something. It was really sad.
Poor dungeons.
I know, you were so sad. I felt so bad. I almost
don't hurt the dungeons.
Just wanted to take it down. Well, I think there are certain types. I think there's one type in particular dungeon that should just go away, and that's the huge illogical mess of a dungeon. Unless that's just like the point of the game is just, you know, to have a crazy dungeon that makes no sense. That's cool. You know, that can happen. And then the other thing is, the other article was more about, particularly with newer players, if they're just not getting into it and you just keep throwing them at dungeons because that happens to be part of the name of the game and you're not getting anywhere, you're never going to get anywhere. You should try something different. Try an urban environment. Try a forest. Something that they're maybe more likely to have a feel for and to be able to connect with. Because, you know, sometimes it's hard to connect with big subterranean spaces that you've never seen in real life. That's how it started.
Okay, so Mike, where do you take it from here? How do you respond?
I think she's right. I think she's right about a lot of it. That, you know, there's a lot of idea that the dungeon is an illogical setting, and everybody talks about, like, you know, the giant room that has a red dragon in it but only has two doors, and they're both sized for, you know, normal medium-sized creatures, and, you know, like, what does it eat, and why is it there, and, you know, it's just waiting. You know, I'm reminded of the monster closets from Doom 3, where, you know, you'd walk up and here's this creature that's been waiting his whole life inside of this tiny cubby for you to walk by so he could jump out, and then you'd shoot him. And, you know, it's so easy to design something like that. Just because you want to do it, right? It gets too much on the gameplay side instead of on an environment that makes sense. And it's the difference. I don't know if you remember when Doom 3 came out, Half-Life 2 came out about the same time, I think. And, you know, Half-Life 2 was a far better game, and we remember it now much more than we remember Doom 3, even though they were both technically very solid games. And it's because Half-Life, the environment made sense. And, you know, it wasn't a dungeon. It was an abandoned You know, it was an abandoned apartment building that you were running through, and it had all the same elements, but it made sense. You understood why it was that way. So I think she's right, you know, about a lot of it. But I also think that there is a fantastic element to it as well, and that's a, you know, that fantastic element has been part of the game for a long time. And it's something that, you know, people like me, I like dungeons. I wouldn't want to have them all the time, and I don't want them to be dumb, and I don't want them to be tiring. But I like this idea. I've always had this image of somebody staring down into a pit and having no idea what's down there and grabbing their sword and jumping on in and facing whatever happens to be down there. It's a, you know, that's a little image I always have in my head when I'm designing games. And if there is anything at bottom of a pit, to me, it kind of loses the fun of that. So that's what I think about dungeons and Tracy's point of view.
I guess it's time for us to dig into this and see if we can't build a dungeon that's going to make Tracy happy. It sounds to me like Tracy's big dungeon problems are big, huge, sprawling dungeons that don't make a lot of sense in terms of story and don't provide a lot of variety in terms of experiences. Does that sound accurate, Tracy?
Yeah.
I have a question for Tracy. And you know, it kind of gets into, you know, define. I don't want to spend any significant time on, like, you know, what we define as a dungeon. But I was thinking back to Fallout 3, which is, you know, this post-apocalyptic game. And one of the first areas that you find is this old abandoned school that's been taken over by a bunch of, you know, cannibalistic, you know, gang people. And it's considered by the game designers and considered by a lot of the players to be a dungeon, even though it's a schoolhouse. So it's above ground, it's below ground, and it's got all the same kind of features you'd expect from a dungeon, but the whole thing is a schoolhouse. Do you still consider that kind of thing a dungeon?
I think it is a problem of terminology. And on one hand, yes, because you are limited in the directions you can go. Like, there are definite walls and definite paths to get through it. But yeah, on the other hand, it could also be urban, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a matter of, like, if you're in this scenario that Mike's describing and it's relatively easy to get out of there, then that's urban to me. If there's some reason that you're stuck in that building, then it becomes a little bit more of a dungeon. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, if there's something going on so you can't just jump out the window, then that becomes more dungeony to me.
Right.
So I guess what we need to – we know what Tracy does and doesn't like about dungeons. Let's hear a little bit about her game so that we can figure out how we're going to make a dungeon for her. So Tracy, I know this is going to be hard and no gamer ever wants to hear this, but tell me about your game.
Well, my game, I think they just made 9th level. It's a Noomshire. I decided to continue with the podcast theme. It's basically a nice big wilderness with some cities and some elves and humans and everybody else. So most of their stuff has been outdoors or in cities or towns. So they haven't done a ton of dungeons, and particularly nothing more than 3 rooms. So I don't know what else you need to know. They just defeated the Shadow Army.
What have been the major conflicts of the story?
Well, so the major conflict.
What are the major conflicts of the setting?
Okay, so the major conflicts of the setting are that Farmouth is full of shipbuilding, and the Elven Woods are full of trees that are ironwood, and so there's the conflict there between the loggers and the elves. Also, the PCs just put down the Shadow Army that was forming. That was like their big dungeon. So that's pretty much dead. There is an area that that could use a dungeon in it, if you guys wanted to try to build on that. And that's basically one of the towns is the water's infected, and the people in town are getting these nightmares that pretty much, if they get hurt in their dreams, they get hurt in real life. But none of them have died yet from it.
Okay, so there's infected water in a that's giving people deadly nightmares.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good starting place for a dungeon. Mike, how challenging do we want to make this for ourselves? Do we want to say, let's see if we can make a giant sprawling dungeon and make Tracy happy? Or no. Should we go the easy route and do something a little smaller?
I vote for the easy route.
Okay. So I think one of the tricks for building a good dungeon is you've got to be able to create some logic to it, right?
Yep.
There's got to be a reason that dungeon exists, and then those reasons become clear through the dungeon itself.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, there was I can't remember who said it. I think was it oh man, one of the D&D guys on the D&D podcast said they have three Fs when they design something. It has to be fantastic, functional, and familiar. I think it was familiar, functional, and fantastic. And those are three things when you're building out any kind of area that you want to make sure are there. You want to make sure people, that your players are familiar with it. This gets to Tracy's point about giant sprawling underground caverns that nobody really has ever seen. So how do you make something like that, mm-hmm. Familiar? It has to be functional. It has to actually work, and it has to make sense in the story that you've provided. It can't just be there, and it has to be fantastic. It has to be above and beyond the norm, something that, inspires awe when it's seen and really kind of grabs people, grabs the attention of the players. So whatever is designed needs to have all three of those functions. And I think that the familiar and the functional both, both address or attempt to address, the concern, the mistaken, hatred for dungeons that Tracy has.
Okay, good. So what do you think we could do in this scenario to make a familiar, functional dungeon? You have any ideas? I have some ideas starting to form in my head I can share.
Can I ask more questions first?
Absolutely.
So, Tracy, what is the water source that is infected? Let me ask all my questions at once. Have you guys gone to the Shadowfell yet? And is that something you want to do? Because you're getting to Paragon, and Paragon, sometimes you'll dip into the Feywild, into the Shadowfell. What's the source of the water, the infected water? Is it natural? Is it like an aqueduct system, or is it coming from a big natural water source? I guess those are the only two questions I have.
Okay. So the town is Darbydale. It's on the banks of the Seusfosser. So it's a stream that goes into it. And that's the main source of their water. And it goes up into, basically part of a swamp. They haven't gone to the Shadowfell or the Feywild yet, although they know of ways to get to both. So that hasn't happened yet. Although.
This is a stupid question. Is there an Underdark in your campaign?
I'm sure there is. We haven't gotten that far. Okay. It's easy for there to be one. I don't have a.
So there could be.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, the Underdark. The Underdark to me sounds exactly like it goes directly against the principles you have, that it is this giant sprawling cavernous network that seems to go on for infinity. That is, directly below the surface, when there is no, as far as I know, natural thing in our world to tie into that.
Right. I actually had to write an adventure in the Underdark once, so I'm aware.
So I have some idea here on the direction we could go with this, that there could be an underground water source that feeds into this stream, or even into the swamp itself if you want to make it a larger event.
I was thinking it was coming from some kind of mountainous area. Did you say it was coming from a swamp?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you say that, Tracy?
Yeah, the mountains are like way to the north, but there could be some hills or some mountains. They haven't really explored that area.
Like a small rocky region.
Who knows what's there? Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also not unusual in the real world for there to be underground reservoirs or whatever, and so you could have a series of caves that involve, you know, a lot of stalagmites and stalactites and dripping water and waterfalls and all that kind of stuff that could then, you know, feed into the swamp or feed into the stream itself. And there could be something going on in that environment.
Yeah, I've got an idea. There's another much like my hero staring into the depths of a big hole and not knowing what's there. There's another you know, little seed I keep coming back to over and over again, which is the idea of ancient things being uncovered, and not always, you know, it's not always best that it's uncovered. So if you go to your Conan the Barbarian movie, and he has this big hilly, rocky area that he climbs up when he's being chased by wolves, and he falls in through, and he falls into this old tomb that's, you know, beneath that rocky area, and it's been there forever, you know, and he finds his sword there, and he climbs his way out. You could have something almost like that, that maybe the stream, or, you know, maybe if you even want, like, maybe the logging that's been going on has changed the path of the water, and the water has started to erode away at a rocky, cavey area. You know, the water has started to kind of take away some of the, and maybe it's been over a long period of time, but what it's uncovered there is maybe an old tomb, or even an old, you know, a crypt of something that was not meant to be, you know, discovered. Like, maybe it's not a good thing. It could be the king, the tomb of an old king, and now the king is disturbed, and now he's going to come back and whoop some ass. But it also might be, you know, an evil king, or an evil, you know, a betrayer, an elven betrayer. You can always go with elves because they're, you know, a million years old. So an elven betrayer.
I had another thought that could tie into that and maybe go a little bit different route as well. Because I spent a little bit of time thinking about, okay, you've got a tainted water source. And I went, that made me think of looking at things that might be involved in poison and what have you, although that's obviously it's not poison, but that's okay. But it got me to I started looking at around the level that we're looking at here. And what I ended up pulling up was Yonti. Mm-hmm. And that perhaps your tomb or whatever it is was the tomb of an old Yonti leader.
A serpent king.
And now the, you know, a group of Yonti has discovered it. Maybe, you know, it's a group of Yonti adventurer-like people. And they've found the old serpent king, and they've started digging it up. And as they're digging it up, the magical energies of the Serpent King are infesting the waters.
Right. Well, and this would work in one way too, because the land had been covered up to about 500 years ago with ice for 1,000 years. So they're finally starting to be able to come back. So that would work.
Yeah.
Which also explains why the Yonti wouldn't be there, because being snake people, you would think they'd stay away from cold places.
Right.
Yeah, and I go with Tracy's idea that a dungeon shouldn't really be giant grid works of caverns and hallways and stuff. I kind of go with the 3-room to 9-room dungeons. I think they're more, you know, I think they fit 4th edition more, frankly, because each of the rooms can be kind of an encounter area. And I'm not real creative in doing like sets of hallways and things like that. You could, but. So to me, the 3-room to 9-room dungeon could work really well. You could do a 6-room where 3 rooms of natural caverns where they could fight cool things like ropers and other, you know, other delvey creatures that have been kind of attracted to the same taint that's been affecting the village. And then you could actually get to the doorway where you find the old ruins. And then there could be a 3-room dungeon in there that could get people through. So you could do the whole thing in a couple of nights. And of course you could extend it out more than that if you wanted to have some extra time. One other possible driver for that taint could be an actual rift, a Shadowfell rift. I think I saw this in a published adventure. I think, Nightworm Fortress, I think had this, where there was an old tomb and down in the tomb was an actual rift to the Shadowfell. I think actually Keep on the Shadowfell had the same thing. But it can be kind of a neat transition if you wanted a way for your players to choose whether or not they wanted to go to the Shadowfell and see what's going on there, vice hanging out in the Prime World.
Let me see if I can merge the two concepts that we seem to be running with here. We've got our Snake King tomb that's been under ice for, would you say, 1,000 years or so?
Yeah.
Okay. So we got the Ice King's tomb. It turns out there was a, you know, maybe there used to be a Yonti empire there that had to fall apart or end when the ice came and the Yonti had to flee the cold. But this great Serpent King was held back. But as the ice has receded, and since your previous adventures deal with the Shadow Army, what if the activities of the Shadow Army accidentally opened up this rift to the Shadowfell, which has reinfused the magic of the tomb? And maybe you no longer even have the body of the Serpent King, but maybe the maybe what's happening down there is that this adventure Yonti group has discovered that in fact there's no longer a body, but instead an egg that's infused with the Shadowfell. And they're trying to get it out, and the party shows up in time to stop them from being able to dig it out, or maybe they don't. And that can lead you to a whole new tier in Paragon and dealing with these Yonti and their shadow-infused reborn Serpent King.
Okay. Sounds good.
In the Dungeon Delve book, one of my favorite D&D books, on page 66, there's actually a 10th level delve. It uses the Dire Tomb set, and it could easily be reskinned and turned into kind of a nice three room tomb. It's got all the tomb components. The monsters would have to be reskinned,
can change the monsters too.
Yeah, or just change them out completely and use the setting. Yeah. But it uses favorite dungeon tile sets that would, I think, fit very well.
Yeah, one of the reasons I ended up latching onto this concept of the Yonti is because I looked at the level range that we're looking at here, and there happened to be 3 level 10 or 11 elite Yonti creatures of different roles that would sort of fit together well and create a sort of little adventuring party.
Yeah, you can make them a mix of undead and live Yonti, that there's a Yonti, you know, excavation party that's going to recover, you know, the artifact or whatever. And there's also the Yonti who have been awakened when the tomb itself opened up, the guardians of this thing. So the party would fight this mixture of live and dead Yonti. And I still like the idea of having a natural cavern that kind of leads to it, so you have an opportunity to use some of those cool, you know, the cool natural bosses like the Roper and other things like that.
So the only thing I would say that we haven't talked much about in terms of how to put this dungeon together is that one of the things I really try to do, especially since 4th edition, is try to make the terrain part of the encounter.
Right.
So what are some ways in this situation that you might suggest making the terrain part of the encounter, Mike?
I think that the poisonous water is, of course, a real easy one. You know, you can always continually have these streams of this poisonous water, and if anybody, you know, goes into it or, you know, weird things can happen. And I like the dream aspect too, that maybe they start to see things differently. Maybe there's a random component on what it does to them as they get close. I think there's lots of different things. There's lots of stereotypical things you could do with the tomb. You know, the different necrotic areas and unholy areas and areas where the ghosts of the dead are reaching out. The egg itself, you know, that idea of something that's kind of drawing people into the Shadowfell. I think that there could be a lot of interest with that. If that's a kind of, you know, malevolent artifact that's trying to draw people in and do things to them, you know, you could really have you could treat it almost like a sphere of annihilation which is one of the traps, I think, from much, much higher. But you could create like a lower version of 10th or 11th level version of that, this kind of orb that, you know, your lead arcane PC could be mentally dueling with the, you know, the main Yonti boss as they're trying to control this egg and use its energy against one party or the other. You know, that's worked pretty well every time I've used it. People have enjoyed this kind of metagame that's going on of, other than just the battle, there's also this battle of control for this much more powerful thing that could really swing the battle one way or the other.
Good. And I think it's also interesting to consider, you know, how might a structure designed by snake people be different than one built by humans, you know? And then you start taking what's familiar and moving away from it a little bit.
I understand. Stairs?
Right. Yeah. You know, no stairs, everything, you know. And ramps, then it makes it, you know, maybe make it more difficult to go up that space than you normally would stairs or whatever. Right. And then combine that with the fact that there's water running, and now you've got a water slide instead of stairs.
Whee!
Right.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point.
You can have all kinds of crazy things with that as well.
Yeah, and that certainly makes it both fantastic and functional, right? That, you know, they go and maybe they don't know what's Yuan-Ti for a while, and they're like, why are these weird, narrow, concave ramps everywhere? Like, these are really hard to walk in, you know, difficult terrain, and I'm sliding down them and everything else. And then they realize, oh, it's because we're fighting snake people, you know, and snake people don't have knees, so they don't have stairs and... you know, that's, or there's a lot of like maybe tubes that they can kind of slither up and down, rather than, you know, any kind of other, method of getting around the dungeon. That could be really interesting for players to have to, or PCs to have to navigate. And it certainly fits two of the three. It's not familiar, you know, that it's not something anybody's likely to see, but when it's both functional and fantastic, I think that people will get the idea and kind of enjoy it. So that's a really good point. It's something I didn't think about.
Well, I'm glad to add something to the conversation. So, Tracy,
yeah,
what do you not like about this so far?
Tell us what we can fix for you.
Out of this, I can't think of much right now.
So we won then.
You won this round.
We have convinced you that dungeons are awesome.
I don't know about the awesome part yet, but you know.
I mean, what
you know? What, go ahead.
Well, what do you not like about them? Like what? When you hear about this, when you hear about kind of caverns that are leading to a tomb with snake stuff in it, you know, what is it that kind of makes you go? Is it a lack of choices?
Well, I mean, sure, lack of choices, but that doesn't bother me as much. I just like the creatures better that you can find in the woods. But I'll be okay with this. My husband might not be, but I'll be okay with it. He doesn't like snakes.
Oh, that's perfect, right? Use the phobia. Right.
So, that's even better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Use phobias. Very powerful.
No, I think this will be pretty good.
I'm making that a DM tip for Twitter.
Oh, yeah, next Mondays or whatever.
Yeah,
I think this will work pretty well, and it'll give me a whole reason to have them go to Paragon Tier.
Yeah, and then, you know, you could have some kind of interesting transitions here too. Does your group like dungeons? Do they enjoy that stuff, or is it your group also kind of fits your twisted logic of we hate dungeons?
Well, I think they don't like dungeon crawls. I know that much. When we did Keep of the Shadowfellows, the game, that's the game I joined in. And at first they were doing the typical, keep turning left so we go through everything and get all the XP. Yeah, and it was just taking forever.
Right.
Part of the problem is we usually only play on a weeknight and we get one encounter in. So if you're in a dungeon crawl, you're going to be in that dungeon forever before you get out. So
sure.
Right. So I think,
I don't necessarily disagree with a lot of what you've said either. I'm usually not a big fan of long, you know, room after room after room dungeons that don't make a lot of sense, and you know they've got the monsters sitting in rooms next to each other, just sitting there waiting for adventurers to come along, somehow surviving and all that kind of stuff. I tend to run dungeons when I design dungeons. I like Mike tend to go with dungeons that are between 3 to 9 maybe up to even 12 rooms at the most. I noticed I'm playing through the Tomb of Horrors right now, the fourth edition version of the Tomb of Horrors, and it's all about dungeons, right? But and they're all 10 to 15 rooms, but it's also fairly linear. You know, it's not, you know, there's not a lot of mapping or always go left or any of that kind of stuff. You're pretty much going to go straight and just try to avoid the traps along the way.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest dungeon delve that I played through in my game was Pyramid of Shadows, which was supposed to be kind of like the fourth edition Tomb of Horrors style. And it was a lot. Actually, the interesting thing is I wasn't crazy about it because it didn't fit my general storyline of, you know, fighting Orcus. It was kind of off the path, but at least one of the players I had said it was his favorite adventure. It was the one he enjoyed the most. And that the whole adventure is a dungeon crawl. I mean, the whole thing from top to bottom, even more so than Keep of the Shadowfell. But what's interesting about it is that the whole dungeon is broken up into wings, and each wing has its own different feel. And it certainly touched on the fantastic element because the rooms change and shift around the people that live in them. So, you know, that was kind of a neat thing. But each of the wings, the players kind of felt like they weren't in just a giant dungeon. They felt like, you know, each wing was something different. And even a couple of them looked like they were outside, even though they weren't. And so it was neat. The other neat thing about that module is thinking about the pyramid, like the pyramid is the antagonist, not some villain that lives inside. That the whole pyramid is trying to eat,
right,
you know, to psychologically devour those that are within it. And that was kind of fun. But yeah, if, you know, I think the minute players say, oh, well, we'll just take the left door because that's where we're going to choose, I think, you know, that's not a decision as far as I'm concerned. That's just a random draw.
All right. So, Tracy, it sounds like you can accept this dungeon for now. I look forward to seeing how it goes and reading about it over on your blog and seeing if you run it and it goes well, or if you, or if you run it and decide that it's horrible and you still hate dungeons. But we have been recording for nearly an hour now, and we haven't gotten to some key parts of the episode. So if it's okay, I'd like to go ahead and move on along. Is that okay?
Sure.
That's good to me.
All right. As long as Tracy's happy with what we've designed, I'm good moving along. Otherwise, we'll go back and start from scratch.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
I'll write this up good.
You'll write this up good. All right. Okay, well, next up we're going to talk about what players can do in a dungeon and what kind of things players need to think about when they are playing in a dungeon. But first, a word from our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games. Noble Knight is a fantastic online and brick-and-mortar game store that specializes in finding you out-of-print material. My pick for this episode is Mike's favorite book, The Dungeon Delve, which Noble Knight is currently selling for less than $24. Mike, since this is the best book you've ever seen, why don't you tell us about it?
I don't know if I'd say it's the best book I've ever seen, but I love this book, and I think I've used almost every dungeon in it at some point. It's, you know, for anybody that doesn't know, it's a, you know, 200-page book that contains 30 three-room dungeon delves all the way from level 1 to level 30, and they're all filled out. They all have the encounters already built. They have flavor text. They have story hooks. They have all the monsters. So it's a really solid book, and they haven't made one since, which really, you know, irks me because I just used – it's so modular. You could grab one room out of here and add that room into your game. You could pick one of the, you know, three rooms and add the three room. You could combine a couple of them. I've used it for about 6 or 7 one-shot games I've pulled about because a three-room dungeon to me is almost a perfect one-night adventure. It's almost exactly – you know, 3 to 4 hours of gaming that you'll get in. I'd say my only complaint is that it's using monsters from pre-Monster Manual 3, which means you, above level 10, you're going to want to do some work on the monsters because they're just not going to hold their own eventually. Or like I've done in some cases, you can just replace the monsters with monsters from Monster Vault or Monster Manual 3 or anything like that. So you don't have to use everything. You can use just the room layout, you can use, you know, just the monsters, you can use whatever you want. And the whole thing uses standard D&D dungeon tiles, although some of the sets that are in here are now well out of print. So it might be difficult to find them. But if you have the dungeon tiles, it's really handy to be able to put this whole thing together. So yeah, it's my favorite adventure book.
I really like it too.
So, and Tracy gives it her seal of approval. And you can find that at Noble Knight. And find links to them and a link to this product specifically or in the show notes over at the website at thetomeshow.com. And be sure to tell them that the Vorpal Network sent you. Last time Mike was on, I recommended a set of dungeon tiles that he convinced me I really wanted to get. And then shortly after the episode came out, they were sold out and I couldn't get it. So I got to make sure to get my products on there before I tell you guys to go out and buy them, apparently.
It's been a common problem with dungeon tiles. They go out of print really fast.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, now let's talk about being a player in a dungeon. You run in, you kill all the bad guys, you kick in all the doors, you poke every bit of the floor with a 10-foot pole, and you walk out with the fat loot. That's pretty much how it goes, right?
Exactly.
All right, well, that was quick. We'll move on. Tracy?
Yes?
If I'm a player in a dungeon, what kind of things do I have to keep in mind?
Well, so one of the things is you should think about whether or not you should be thinking of yourself as a player in a dungeon. That's one of my biggest problems with dungeons is that a lot of times they're set up to become more of a game between the player and the dungeon than necessarily about the characters.
I agree. Sometimes dungeons and other parts of D&D become a contest for the player and not for the character. And I think it's important to try hard when in a dungeon to force yourself to think in character and to think about character knowledge and not necessarily player knowledge. And hopefully your DM is doing the same, so that all comes out, you know, fair.
Right. And I mean, you may be the type of person who just doesn't care and you just want to play the game, and that's totally cool too. But if you have half the group who wants to play in character and half the group that wants to play a game, it gets kind of difficult at the table and tensions can flare. So that's always a good thing to keep in mind. When you're in a dungeon, that means there aren't many opportunities to go out and buy maybe some of the things that you need to get through the dungeon. So preparing before you go in is always a good idea. Not a lot of places to buy candles when you're in the dungeon, unless there happens to be some kobolds who are willing to sell them to you.
So take care of the details ahead of time, whether it be making sure you've got the supplies you need to keep track of light sources and who's going to be doing the map if you need some mapping, if you're doing a big dungeon crawl or whatever. Even sometimes it's good not to even think about some of the tactics, like if we need to get out of here, how do we do that? And do we make sure that we leave a back door open?
Right. And always keeping a lookout for a place to hole up for the night if you need to. Easily defensible for those wandering monsters that are sure to attack.
Okay, good.
I think that's mostly of how to...
Anything else?
I can't think of anything else.
Okay. The only other thing that's on my list of things to mention that we haven't talked about yet, and this advice, I did a shout-out on Twitter as I was writing this script about, what kind of things would you talk about when you're giving players advice on dungeons? And a lot of these kinds of things that we've already talked about came up and were mentioned by various people. And one person said something that sort of is true to my heart. And his advice was, make sure that when you're in a dungeon, you continue to play boldly.
Right.
We're playing fourth edition, so a lot of us aren't necessarily looking for the same experience we did when we were playing first edition D&D. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm bored by the dungeon where I have to go around and poke everything with a 10-foot pole. Right. I want to be able to play boldly and say, I'm not going to search every single square for a trap. I might stop and search in the logical places, but otherwise I'm going to play boldly and move forward and take risks. And that's part of the D&D experience, even if it's in a dungeon. That advice specifically came from Brian Ingard from GameCrafters.net, who I had on this episode, the show once before. I need to get him back on sometime. But that's often advice I have for anybody playing anything in D&D, but it's easy to forget that in dungeons and you start becoming overly cautious. Mike, what do you want to add to this?
Really just a couple of things. I agree. I agree with all the stuff that you guys have said. You think outside of your character sheet, I think it's one of them. Try to think about, imagine yourself in the actual environment and think about what kind of stuff you can do in that environment instead of saying like, well, I'm best at athletics, so I'm going to try to find athletic-y stuff. I think that's a big problem with the way the skill system of 4E works, that everyone tends to only worry about the skills that they're good at and doesn't go after anything that they're bad at. And DMs sometimes work with that by putting in DCs that are really hard for, you know, on the assumption that, well, only the character who's really good at it is going to do that. So trying to think outside of just what the numbers that are on the sheet and try to think about the circumstances. One, and probably the only other one, is being courteous to everybody else, that, you know, the players, much like the DM, should be watching the interest of the players and judging how fast or how slow they need to move things forward. I think a player needs to kind of judge the DM and work with the DM to recognize that, okay, maybe this is just an empty room and I should stop poking every single tile with a stick because we're going to be here until 3 a.m. this morning trying to, you know, get through the three rooms that we had done. But I think a lot of that kind of falls on the DM as well. The DM needs to set the pace. I tended to find that we had one player who was more impatient than the others, and some of them would just sit there and poke and prod and do all kinds of checks, and the other one would just like rip books off the shelf and touch anything that looked like a rune and kick in any door and just activate any possible thing that might have been a trap just to keep things moving forward, and figured I can be healed and I can be rezzed, so I'm not too worried about it. And you kind of want to avoid that. You want to make sure that the pace of the game, you know, generally fits what the players want. And the players need to be, you know, getting cues from the DM on how they should be interacting with a certain room. So that would be my advice.
Good. Fantastic. I think it's short, but I think that's our advice on being a player in a dungeon. We spent much more time building a dungeon, but that's sort of where the core of our conflict was in this episode, I think. So
conflict.
So to summarize, yeah, to summarize, I think we said, for the most part, unless it's just a rare occasion, we're not a big fan of the large dungeon crawls, but we found a way to make Tracy love dungeons by sticking to smaller dungeons that make sure they have internal logic and consistency, but at the same time have some fantastic elements and terrain and all kinds of things going on. And then we said, if you're going to play in a dungeon, make sure you figure out what you need to be prepared for and do that preparation. Make sure you separate player knowledge and character knowledge. Continue to play boldly and not worry so much about the numbers, but focus on playing your character and doing the role playing you need to do. Does that sort of summarize our last hour and 2 minutes of conversation in about 30 seconds?
Yep.
We won. That's the main summary. Dungeons are good.
It's true. We win. Tracy now has to write a post about why Dungeons
Rock. We're
going to
see an article. I was wrong.
You're going to be waiting a long time.
All right. Well, I'm going to call this episode 158. I want to thank our sponsor, Noble Knight, for continuing to support the show. And I want to thank our guest for today, Tracy Hurley. You go first. Where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me at SirDarkMagic.com or on Twitter at SirDarkMagic. And a few other places, but that'll do for now.
All right. And, you know, I own half those other places, right? So
yeah, temporary hit points, and then Lore Master, and 4Geek4E, and DM Roundtable, and, you know, stuff like that.
Okay, you weren't supposed to actually mention them all. Now I have to go out and find links and do all that. That's like work.
Aw.
Mike Shea. Thank you for coming on, and let's see, how are you going to convince people to go to slyflourish.com/book before we say goodbye?
Oh, you did it again. I don't need any convincing. You want to be a great DM, that's where you go. So, yeah, slyflourish.com, right. twitter.com/slyflourish, and slyflourish.com/book.
And those are the URLs that Mike wants to pimp. You can, of course, get a hold of me easily enough. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com.
Can I pimp one more thing that's not mine, but I think is really awesome?
Yes.
So, Gamma World. We didn't talk much about Gamma World. I think you've done another show on Gamma World. But there's a really great tool on Critical Hits that they just put out. Dave Chalker and Jared Von Hindman put this together. And what is it called? Oh my God. The itemizer, I think it's the itemizer or something like that. What's it called, Tracy?
I thought it was like the Junkalizer or something.
Yeah. Junkalator? The Junkalator. I think it's the Junkolator. And it is a way to, with a single click, generate like power cards from random junk, and it automatically pulls images from Google Images. And it's just awesome. I think it's the best tool I've seen in Gamma World thus far. I wanted to pimp that because I think it's awesome.
Right on. So I got to make sure to link to that too. Sweet. All right. So as I was saying, you can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can go visit the forums, which are available through the Gamers Haven podcast at gamershavenpodcast.com, which I'll also have linked in the show notes. And of course, make sure you call the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for upcoming episodes, including the soon-to-be-released episode about the web app version of the Character Builder. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 158, where I have found an ancient ruin of an underground complex of tunnels and rooms with odd and deadly and generally useless features full of all sorts of monsters that, for some reason, don't bother to kill each other, despite the fact that Mike Shea is in one room and Tracy Hurley's in the other, and the two of them just absolutely hate each other. But they've never left their own rooms to see that the other one is there. In this episode of
The Tome. I'm on the wall.